if I have your permission to interview you. And you know, you can either say yes or tell me to go away now. The first question is going to be, how did you imagine England before you came? Did you have any imagination about England?
Yes.
And you know, what was your thoughts about it? And did you live up, did England when you came, you know, did it sort of match your imagination?
No, because apart from, I mean, it was mainly books because you didn't have television and that sort of thing, or anything, or films. And you see things like My Fair Lady and that sort of, which gives you an emphasis on how people live this high life, and they go to Ascot and all of the rest of it. And you're brought up to think that the English people are, you know, the upper class, and they don't clean or work on the street or anything like that. They've got other people to do the work. You come here and you think, what are they doing there? Yeah, so one's expectation was somehow disappointing. So what you had expected, or what you've been brought up to believe. I suppose it's like lots of things in America as well.
So, you know, what was your memory about home, you know, and could you tell me where did you, whereabouts did
I'm
you,
from Guyana,
yeah.
in Bedford-Wiping, a village, and I can still see my village, even though when I went back in 96, I was so disappointed, I cried. It just shows you when you're growing up as a child, things are so overblown, because you see it in rose-tinted glasses, and it was wonderful. And I go in a great big pothole in the road. You're almost embarrassed to think that you grew up and in this wonderful place that you had in mind, and people, you knew everybody because everybody you respected, and they're all family and family. I think one of the things that you remember when you're that I felt when I came to England, I felt quite lost because I came from a community where, in this street that I live, there's my uncle, my dad, and the bit of land that we had there. We had another house we'd let to some people, and Mrs. Aaron, and she was like a grandmother, she was a very nice old lady. And all the people in the street we knew all the way down. Then up the road with another aunt, and then a couple of houses down, my grandmother. My grandmother, and in the yard where she lives, was one of her sister's children, and then one of her grandchildren there, and then another. And then you go further down, then a sister there, and a sister's daughter. So in this sort of square, for all this family. And you can't move for doing anything wrong because how could you go home and complain because you get another one? And then we go further up in the village. There's another lot of family because this side were the Cushes and that side were the Joneses because my grandmother married twice. Well, the first husband died. I never knew the story. My sister in America has got a tree, the family tree with everything. Because my uncle lives next to us, he's Cush, and the other son is Cush, and the daughter is Cush, and my father's the only one who's Jones, and he's the youngest one. But then I find out that he's got some sisters, two, three sisters, and a brother. No, is it three sisters? One, two, yeah, three sisters and a brother. So all together, four or four, eight. So he came from a family of eight, but not all together. Half sisters and then this half brothers and so on. But you know them everywhere, they're everywhere. And one local family is related to another local family, who is related to another local family. So everybody call cousin or auntie or what, Mrs. So and so. Never call anybody by it. My friend was 94, 96. We were talking about that. I was taking her to church on Sunday. We were talking about my grandson said to me the other day, why do you, my friend, my children call this very good friend of mine, Joyce, Auntie Joyce. Mm-hmm. And another friend I got in London, we were trained together, he's from Guyana, Auntie Joyce. Is it your sister? No. Why do you call it Auntie Joyce? I said, we were brought up, it's respect too. You don't call anybody by their first name. And he said, I suppose back in the olden days they used to do that here. I wonder when it changed. Since I've been here, the teacher's name has been changed from Mr. Something Something to the Christian name.
Yeah. It's true.
And I wonder why children haven't got any manners.
Mm-hmm. That is true.
So I had to do a lot of retraining of the brain, if you like, of understanding what is accepted and what's not accepted. And doing mental nursing when I came here first, there are a lot of old people and a lot of maybe still people who have been left by their family. Mm.
So you might not ask, what year did you start your training?
In 56.
Okay.
I came here in 56.
In September.
No, in Epsom.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. And I used to cry for these people who didn't have visitors. Mm. Why didn't they have visitors? Where are their daughters? Where are their sons? And that just really hurt me to think that they were... Oh, I mean, I was so homesick when I came here, but I was so homesick, you don't believe it. And to find my grandmother, my grandmother died the night since I came, I was inconsolable. And I think these people got nobody to come and see them. But it's amazing how, while you're trying to immerse yourself into the culture and the situation, to be accepted, you have to change your mindset into what is here and don't think there's anything on towards. So much so when my mother came to England, we went to Cambridge and we were going down, just passing this lady, good morning, Mrs. Oh, do you know that lady? No, don't you say hello to people? No, that might drop you off. Oh, she said, my goodness, what is the God forsaken place is this? And it pulls you up, you know, because you don't, unless it's somebody you know, you just walk past people. And she couldn't understand everybody just walking, going down, but nobody would stop and say hello. No, Mom, you don't do that. She said.
So what brought you to Cambridge then?
My husband. Got married and came to Cambridge. He was working for Pi.
What year did you come to Cambridge?
1964.
Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm. He got married in 64 and I came here.
Did you work at the old hospital at all?
No, when I came here, I was doing part two midwifery. No, I just finished my part two midwifery. I did my general training at Central Middlesex in London. Then I did part one, and then I went to Bedford to do part two. Because that's how you could use the part one, part two. And I just finished part two. And I'd done my exam. Then we got married and I came here. So then I came to Cambridge City Council. I was working on the district because I wanted to be on the district so that anyone would go back and talk to me, as a district nurse stroke midwife. So I did the district nursing and going around with the midwives, and then I got the results and I passed, but then I was a midwife. District nurse midwife, yeah. So I did midwifery 64, 65. Then 65 November, David went to Iran and I joined him. And when we came back in 66, early 66, he got this job in Sierra Leone. Then we went to Sierra Leone and left there in 68.
So did you work whilst you were in those countries? Were you working when you went to Iran?
No, I delivered a baby in Iran. I did the unforgivable thing is I went and ride a bicycle. Children ride bicycle, not ladies. Yeah. So I got reprimanded by my friends. These are the lovely Iranian people who took to me, and oh, they were so lovely. Taught me all sorts of things. I learned Farsi and learned to play bridge. That's where I learned to play bridge. Because they did nothing. I mean, they are servants for everything. And there was just Lilith going every morning, having coffee and what have you, and talking to them and teaching their children English and talking. And in the afternoon, after going, and if they have a party, where's Lilith? Where's Lilith? They got on very well there. And then this lady, she was English, married to an Iranian. I think there was an Iranian.
Mm-hmm.
And her houseboy in the chapel cooked something for him. His wife was expecting a baby. But where we were in this compound, it was divided up into two sections. The more senior managerial staff lived one way, and the more junior lived in another section. And then there's the rest of the people there. And this chap, you know. So if you, and then there was a small nursing home. Was it a nursing home? No, it wasn't a nursing home. It was a small surgery for emergency and so on. But that's only for the upper one and certain days, and then the juniors could go, but not the natives. So he is his first baby. And usually the local ladies or women shadows and all of them, and they do the delivery. But he was telling me that a lot of the babies die because these women, they're not trained, and they'll deliver the baby. Sometimes the women might bleed to death or whatever. And then the lady told him that I'm a midwife, and he asked me if I'll deliver their baby for them, which was Mary Jim. And I delivered this baby. Yeah, that was wonderful. So then somebody said to me afterwards, Lilith, at the time there was a Shah, you could have been sued. I'm going blind. So I went to Sierra Leone. I was working as a stewardess for ground staff for BUA. This chap was the manager for BUA. And after a year, you have to come home for holiday and so on. So I came home for holiday, and when I went back, I think, I don't know what happened. That position had finished, and so I thought, what should I do? And I thought, well, I can set up a clinic here. And then I met another girl from Guyana, and she was working in America with the aid factory, giving food. Bulgur and milk and that sort of thing to schools and different organizations like that, but mainly to schools and head teachers and many teachers and to clinics and so on. And she said she's trying to negotiate this distributing this food, but she said it's not been going to the right places, and the people who don't need it are the ones who are taking it, and obviously for the ones who. And I said, well, what I can do, can set up, a clinic. I said, try that. I said, well, I'll give you the food and you can distribute it. Then I had to go to the, and then he said, the chief, the paramount chief. The paramount chief is like the mayor of the town.
Okay.
So you had to go and see him to say, you want to do this, and how are you going to do it? They have no money to give to you. It's something you're going to do voluntarily, and you're going to provide everything. Providing you're not asking them for anything, so go ahead and do it. So then I was telling the people who were around, because there's a lot of expatriates, they were working on the runway, the electricians, the engineers, the surveyors, you know, a lot of overseas people there. And every Friday they used to go to the airport, the lovely bar there. They drink themselves silly, but all right. I had this bucket and I said to them, I challenged them, if you have more than two bears, you put the price for that next bear in there. And I raised some money for utensils, for cups and various things like that, and more, because I didn't want to go into Freetown, because you have to take a ferry to go to Freetown to buy a little shop around. I could get things like these enamel plates, you know, and cups and spoons and so on, and cups and things. But I then there was a small surgery there. But the clinic, oh my God, because I wanted to have a voluntary job in the clinic. I couldn't get a good job, a voluntary job in the clinic. And there were women with their babies on their backs walking for eight hours to get there in the morning to be seen. So that sometimes they're 4 o'clock in the morning waiting until it's open. Before then, they could be seen and walk all the way back with a very sick child. So then I thought, well, sometimes when you have a good intention, it's best not to go in with a size 10. Just gradually get yourself in. And I thought, well, identify a certain group then to do something. And I thought, well, there's a lot of women here who are pregnant. Why don't I concentrate on the antenatal mums and children and the newborn? And that's what I did, and I started talking to them about hygiene, and because although the paramount chief has got this great compound with 8 or 9 wives, 400 children, they're not educated, they're not, you know, they're just there, and some might escape when they go to school and so on. It's not a lot. And I thought I had to go to this paramount chief to explain what I'm going to do, to think that I don't want to be careful. You may be coming and wanting to poison these people, or you may want to do it. You never know. Sometimes people's intentions are not always honorable.
Yes, that's right.
And if you've been accepted, you've got to be very careful. So I did play my part. And David, bless his heart, he always encouraged me. No, I want to do it, because a lot of people say, oh, you don't do that, I mean, what do you do with these people? It's always what you do with these people. And I don't care. If it doesn't come off, it doesn't come off. Well, the chap who used to be our houseboy, a great cook, absolute cook, he was wonderful. Did everything, he cleaned. I think he was taught by some nuns, and he lived with these nuns. So he knows English cooking brilliantly. He could do a better roast than I can. And things like that. And he's always respectful. And I bought him some white things to wear, white shoes, socks, and trousers, and tops. And Jan used to do the garden. They're not literate, but they're kind, they're good, and they do things. And Amadou was very good, but Capella, my cook boy, is very fond of they make this local drink. It's very lethal, and he drinks it. They have to be careful, because sometimes they make them go blind. Oh, and he's always black. So Amadou, was it there or Muslim? Amadou is looking after Kapena, makes sure Kapena doesn't drink. And so I told him about this clinic I was going to do. So I said to them, I don't want to make my English food. Just you tell me what Dirk would like to do. And this lady's given me this bowl of wheat, and they had the cornmeal. And we were right on the beach, you see. And you got there, they pull their nets in, and all this fish you can have, and prawns, with prawns and everything like that. And so I bought the fish, got them. And sometimes I'll get some meat and let them do the cooking, what they like. Palm oil, they let them do the palm oil to do that, and the jollof rice, so, and you know, to feed them up. And I used twice a week, I think I did that. And the first couple of weeks, I had about a dozen people came. And gradually, the board went round that this is happening. I was overwhelmed. They were so pleased, and you know, and it was so sad because some of these women used to have infection of all sorts because they have all these scabs and all these clothes they wear and their stuff. And when it rains, if there's a puddle, they wash themselves there in the water. And so I have to teach them about the baby or washing their hands and be careful of the baby. Because you see lots of, while they're breastfeeding the baby, the flies get in their eyes and oh my God. And you know, just train them in their by net and put over there when they're breastfeeding the baby. So they have this net over them, little things like that. And that went on for a good 6 months, I think, but then we had to go on holiday again and came back. When I said to the doctor's wife, she was half Lebanese and her husband was Sierra Leone, and she had trained in England, she was a nurse and was trained in England. And I said to her, I'm going to this thing, going away for a while, I'm coming back after a month. And could you just carry it on for me? Because the women are coming. He said, where do you get the food from? I said, well, this lady gives me the milk and the burger and so on. But I buy the oil and the meat and the chicken fish. If you think I'm going to do that, I'm not going to spend my money on them. I said, well, here's some money. She said, if that runs out, I'm not going to buy any more.
Wow.
When I came back, we came back under VC-10. When the flight arrived, I said to David, lots of people at the airport. While we were on board, I didn't hear them say that there's any VIP on board. And the flight landed and one or two important people came down. It's all flock of women all dressed out, you know, in their big dress and their hat and they're dancing and dancing. For me.
Beautiful.
Carol, I cried. I just said, oh, madam, we're so glad to see you. Oh, madam, that other madam dot com. That other madam finished. No, we know not finished. And my clinic just went around. We only had another 4 or 5 months, and I thought, can't pick it up and carry on. They just go around and see them, and they come and see me, and talk about things, and I feed them. But I couldn't carry the clinic on anymore.
So yeah, sad.
Well, it was lovely, you know.
It's so sad.
And the manager of the airline, no, BUA, who I was working for, he died some 8 years ago. And his wife died 2 months ago. So I'm going to her funeral.
I'm sorry.
In 2 weeks' time. She stopped by me like, Maggie. So that's what I told you. When I went to do health esteem, I said to David, I want to be more going to do have children and small going to school, blah blah blah. I thought, wait a minute, I've been doing all sorts of things. I didn't you if you did something, you did it, but you maintained the garden and, yeah. I speak to the chairman if I'm home. So I said to the children, you know, this lady said to me, I'm going to self esteem.
Is that here in Cambridge?
Yeah.
What year was that?
1980. And I said to the children, let's go to Daddy, just to go out. Michelle said to him, Dad, don't be such an old frump. If Mum wants to go and do be a helpster, then she only has to work 9 to 5. She doesn't have to work nights. And then you don't want to take me to the hospital then. And then she take me home and then she falls asleep and she can't beat me up at school. No, she won't. This is my 9-year-old. And so it's what happens. And I said, will you determine? I said, well, I don't even know if I'm going to get in. My friend came and saw me and said, you look very sad. It's not like you, Lila. You've been very cheerful. What's the matter? I said, I'm putting plaster. I was working for 18 months in the village college as a school nurse. I said, all I do is...
Cotton Village.
Put on plaster and give them paracetamol. I can't be doing all that. So he said, well, I'm going off to Stevenage College. Here's the address if you want to. He said, you have to do this psychometric test. And then if you get through that, then there's another test and an interview. And if you get through that, then there's the final interview.
And this is in 1980s?
Yeah. So I went and did a psychometric test and I surprised myself. Because you know psychometrics has all these shapes and various things you have to put together. Never done that before. But I got this because I play bridge and things. I like drawing shapes and making shapes and looking at shapes. And when I was a child, when we in Guyana, you lay in the veranda, you look up in the sky. Sometimes it's cloudless sky. If you see a few clouds, you're so happy. I'm used to make shapes with the clouds, what it could be in. Look, I would sit, I lay in a thing and I do know and I propelled that too. At my age of 88, I'm still propelled back again. So I went and did that. Right, I got through. Got through the first interview, and then they had to write an essay to say why you want to be a helpster. I said, David, I've got to write this essay. I don't know. I've been ages since I've written an essay since I did my midwifery. I haven't done any more exams or anything like that. He said, oh, that helped me. I said, but then I don't want to write this essay. You said to me, why don't you write about what you did in Sierra Leone and started up that company? I said, don't be silly. This is doing helpers here in England. They don't want to know what I did in Africa. So you'd be surprised. It's something that you've done. I was very proud of you doing that. Then I'll help you. I said, well, you sometimes forget some of the things, but that's why I remind you. And this is what I did. And he stayed me through the session. So then I had the final exam interview to go to, which comprises the principal, the tutor, and some and supervisor, five people there. And I got talking, that's how did you get home first? And the principal said to me, I noticed in your essay you talked about a clinic you started up in Sierra Leone. Would you like to tell us a little bit about it? My daughter used to always say, Mum, if you got anything to me, if they ask you anything, talk about what you know. So I was away. I said to David, guess what? Oh, yes, I thought something like that. I said, did you realize the principal of the health assisting course worked in Africa? She was going over there to train the supervisors there and the nurses in healthcare.
Wow.
And knows all about paramount chief and the, you know, to get through the paramount chief and all these things that you've got to do for anything. How did you manage to do that? And I did it. So then I got through to go and do the harvesting course. So thank you, darling. You know more than I do. Do you see? See, you're too stubborn. You don't know this. Yeah. And that's how I became a health visitor.
So were you a health visitor for how long then in Cambridge?
Mm-hmm. 14 years, I think.
Oh, wow.
Or was it 17 years? I keep forgetting. For 15 years. So I went up to 94 when my mother died. Yeah. Yeah. 94.
Mm. So what was it like those days? How did the system, you know, the house visiting system work? Did you go from house to house or did you have a clinic?
We were health visitors take over from the midwives. Mm. 6 weeks after.
Is it 6 weeks?
No, fortnight after. And you look after them for 6 weeks. And then you have them in the clinic and you watch their weight, help the mothers to see if there's, you know, have an eye on disease. You suspect they might be going to postnatal depression or any anxiety or their new coping system, any problems you might notice in the home that children are neglected. You can call in the TP or call in the social services. You go to conferences and you have meetings with the GP to say, and you work with the GP because the patients you were looking after all are the GP's patients. So then you work with the GP. So if there's anything you're worried about, you can go to the GP to double check with them and so on. Yes, and you do the clinics. And then you do certain tests. 6 weeks you do there to check whether they're meeting their percentile scale. They're doing all the right thing here and lifting their head up. And then you do the hearing tests at 7 months. And then you do the 18 months check. A 2.5 year check, and in between times, if there's anything you can identify, like somebody need, if you suspect they're not seeing very well, you can refer them to the ophthalmologist, the hearing clinic, you can do the ontology. If they're standing, they're not standing very well, they may have a bit, you can offer to the orthopedic people, and then physio, they may need physio. Because there's some children are born floppy and you'll probably find there's some neurological disorder. It's best to check it out earlier to get something done. And then you can then you discover that there's a cerebral palsy or there might be a normal birth at first, but then gradually they're developing a certain failings and they're meeting the. There's a sort of an average age where they should do certain things, so it's like a guideline. If you notice about that age, they're not doing those sort of things, you can call in somebody and then you weigh them, check them, advise mom feeding, the breastfeeding, bottle feeding, early weaning, types of food, give them more and sort of type of vegetables. When they're teething, recommend things that you can do for them. And then you've got to find out about their issues, like by the time they're teething, see, people say get Bongella and all that sort of thing, but they must be careful for them not to have the Bongella that has alcohol. Adults who are bad people
think about that. Yeah.
And lots of things like that. Mm-hmm. So you've got to learn all that. And you get lots of leaflets and pamphlets from the different organizations, like the what's the milk now? Up to milk.
Oh,
or
yes.
Cow and gate, whatever, to find out what's in it and what's not in it. They're looking up also for allergies, and if the child keeps vomiting type of milk, there might be an allergy to the milk or the quantity or whatever, then you can refer them to something, you can refer them to. Yeah. So it's also very halfway measure to do that.
So did you have any particular patients that stood out in your mind?
Oh, lots. Not so much patients as the mothers. In certain parts of Huntingdon, it's very deprived, and they are the overflow from London.
Okay.
And so they're about second generation.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to look at having their babies at 16 and 15. And they don't even know their head from their tail, and that they're being wanted to be mothers. And you've got to look up for abuse. Child abuse. Because it's a child looking after a child.
Yeah.
So then you get in touch with social services, because there are most of them are under the social services, and to form some sort of joint up thinking to look after these girls. Like we did look, caring for yourself, of course. Because I said, everybody's wanting to do something for the babies, or wanting to do something. What about the moms?
Mm.
You know, to see to them. And then we started up this group where we had lecturers come and talk to them about budgeting, dieting, you know, just looking after themselves, looking after their, and things like that. Get them, and you don't realize how ignorant they are, these girls. They haven't got a clue about in their own personal hygiene that they can see to understand them. So you've got to go back to these basics. And that's sort of a very non-derogatory or non-attacking way to talk about it. Then I have loud jokes and things about it. And they get all right, and they can come to the clinic and see you and say, wait a minute. And at the clinic, sometimes you can identify one or two moms who are struggling. And then another group I set up was, after the 6 weeks check, start a course where they just came once a week, and we sat down, we had coffee and biscuits, and if one of them wanted to make a cake, they bring cake. And we start to talk about how they're coping with the babies, how they had the different lectures and talks with the midwife on what to expect when they're going to labor, what the labor is going to be like, how they're going to be cared for, and that sort of thing. And how did it transpire to them? Did everything come up to their expectations, or was there anything they want to say that could be done better or change or whatever? And to get them talking, and get them talking about things that they dreaded. They had the first bath. Have they done the first bath, their baby? And you find, even with the 6 weeks, they do top and tail. And by the 6 weeks, they haven't bathed the baby yet. Because they're terrified that they will drop it on the floor. So then I'll say things to them, now ladies, don't be embarrassed if you haven't bathed your babies yet. You give them top and tail, so you're looking after, make sure they're clean. Because I tell you what, Uncle Tom Cobley and all have had a baby, and they're going to tell you what to do. This baby is yours. Your baby is your baby. And between you two, 24 hours, you're learning to understand each other. You're learning the little quirks, when they cry, when they don't cry. And gradually, things will come to you, but don't let people take away your confidence. Everybody thinks you don't know anything because they've had a baby. Yes, thank you. But just do your own thing. Okay, and I'm there, I'll come and see you. And you can always spot the one in the corner who's absolutely petrified, but they've got to keep in with the rest of you. And I'll say quietly to them, I'll come and see you. Shall I come and we have a cup of coffee? And it will all pour out. I was telling somebody about that the other day, whose wife had a dreadful time in hospital and aftercare with a that he never saw the midwife. The health visitor or anything like that. I mean, where did all those things go to? I said, it depends on the health visitor, because it's not something that is laid out.
Mm.
You've got to be very intuitive to what you're doing to really to identify that need. And what I found was, in the area where I was in Ramsey, a lot of the RAF were going away and coming back and then stationed. And even there, there's a division. The officers' wives didn't mix with the soldiers' wives. You see, but when they come together and have a baby, they're all together. Yes, you get to know them and understand them. And they don't want to feel they've been let down. And also their husband is away and they're alone. And they've just had this new baby. He just had some leave to come and be. Your mum is miles away. Go and stay with your mum for a little while. You know, that's why they don't come to clinic next week. You know, and things like that. Just to give them the confidence that they can do things without somebody just rubbing at them and say, why are you doing that? Mm. And I enjoy that.
You sound excellent.
Enjoy that. Mm. When I was in Huntington, there was one particular mother, and she was running the social services, rings around the social worker. Well, another thing, I mean, some people are quite right when they say some health visitors are twin pals and they sit up and care and do this and how you get a home with a child today, you know. No hands-on. It was very much hands-on. And this one lady, and she had several children with different husbands. And this last chap she was, which was quite a younger chap, and this child she had. So all her other children have been into trouble. But for some reason, she's a bit loud. And she comes to the clinic and that, and my friends, health visitors, would always make sure they're looking after somebody else. And this one is waiting. Lilith, she's waiting for you. Hi, darling, how are you? God, you're looking well today. I think you did a special effort to brush up and looking good today. You did it for me? Good girl. I've got a clue I'm talking about, haven't you? How are you getting on with it? I mean, oh, I'm getting on with someone. Please, can see we're both in a nose and a nose, nobody was there.
No, when you come.
That's a lot on your side. You can walk all that way, push the pram. Yeah, I came with my friend. She was coming, so I go, you did it because you could have stayed at home, but you did. You came. Thank you, dear. I come and see you. And it's one of these houses. Our visitors can have a very bad name about certain things. It's one of these houses when you go and they offer you a cup of tea. You just had a cup somewhere else because you didn't want that. Because the nappy with the dish is there, the sink is piling with how many weeks the washing up is there. But you sit and you just chat, and you gaze around, you look around, but not to make the person feel. But another one of my colleagues would go in and say, what's your dog is better? Why don't you clean up this in? And they'll probably say, there's a dog, just go. You know what I mean? So you've got to be very good. But you could find a way to get around to say to them, did you realize that so-and-so? No, because he's not doing so, and he's not doing so, I don't know. I really like that lady because she's had four children, four different husbands, and they've all had something wrong with them, bless them. The boy was a thief. Eventually, he had to be taken to another school. The other one was ADHD, so he went to a special school here in Pookington. The little girl was the brighter one. She was just nice. And then the little boy, he was a thug, so was his father. Oh. And he used to try and beat up the sister. And one day I got to talking to her, and I thought, she's not that bad. I mean, she can't read and write very well, but I mean, she's not that bad. She just has had so much to do with social work and people not treating her well, and she's getting her room back, and she's not going to let anybody sit on her. And I got to talking to her, and it might take some years gradually getting her. And she was adopted, and before she was adopted, she was fostered, and she sort of went from pillar to post. And she did not have much of an upbringing. Some people showed her love, some didn't show her love. So where would she get it to give? You know what I mean? Yeah. So this lashing out is, I'm going to reject you to see how much you say you care about me, you care about my children. And if I push you and you go, I know you're no good, and I could get you. As much as you used to say it, you didn't say directly to me, why are you still around? Why are you still coming to see me? I said, because you're a mother and so am I, and I know you try your best. And this boy who, there was an Indian shop around the corner called the package shop. I said, you mustn't say, that's not mine. And the mother said to me, with this Turag of a new boyfriend she's got, the boy didn't show any respect to her. Let me just ask.
I have to say that I think you're one of the most incredible people that I've met.
Well, I must say it thanks to my husband as well, because I know lots of people could not have attained the things they wanted to do had they not got support.
Mm.
And I think he was very supportive to me. Mm. And helped me. Bless him. Yeah. And that's another story, my Samaritan. Anyway, I got down to finding about that lady, and, you know, and she then became friends with me. Although she was sort of pushing.
Incredible.
It just shows you what patience and kindness can do. Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely incredible. I was wondering whether you've, well, obviously I will type this all up and I'm going to give it back to you to read word for word. And I was wondering if you have any pictures that would accompany that, but you feel is suitable that I could actually take some snaps at a later date for exhibiting in the museum in Cambridge.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's such, it's so incredible. You know, I think you're one
pictures.
Yeah.
I did that clinic in Sierra Leone, I didn't know.
So I'm just wondering, you know, what advice you would give to a young person who is just starting life, you know.
Always have a goal and know that there's something you really want. Because I remember when I was 7, I saw this lady taking a baby to the house, and I thought, how fun, how great. I want to be a midwife, I want to be a nurse, because then I can help people and I can take babies to them. So always know what you want.
Mm-hmm.
It might not always come out, but have a goal. Because if you haven't got a goal, you're wandering. Yeah, and be strong. Don't let anyone put you off from what you believe in something. Honesty. Love yourself. Don't let anyone put you down. If somebody says you can't do something, you said, I'm sure, you probably feel I can't, but I know I can. And go for it. Yeah, because I could have been, you know, being sidelined lots of times. But no, quietly, I got there.
And you are amazing.
My mother was a very quiet sort of person, but determined. My father was always says to us, don't let anything frighten you unless you realize what it is. Because you don't know what you're running away from. You run away, and you don't know what you're running away from. So why did you run? Face it, can't be all that bad.
Mm.
And I said to my grandson now, when I was trying to pour this bit of tube for the watering the plants in the garden, it was stuck between the ivy and the thistles and everything, and I was chopping away and getting it out. He said, you're wasting your time, you're wasting. I said, my father says, patience and endurance will see you through. Patience and endurance. Don't give up. Don't give up.
And I'd like to thank you very much for this interview, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you.
Beautiful. Really wonderful.